Good afternoon. So hopefully you're here for operating systems. This is 4414001. So there's a course webpage which is linked off CoLab. So just going through logistics quickly. This course will have coding assignments, which you can see on CoLab. They are mostly in C or C++. When possible, I recommend C++. The assignments are generally have 1 or 2 weeks to do them. If there's 2 weeks, there's usually a checkpoint submission in the middle. You should take that as a hint that we believe the assignment is harder and might be worth more. Schedule is aggressive. Some assignments are going to use a teaching operating system. So this is a simplified OS based on an old Unix version. This is built by some people at MIT. It theoretically boots on real x86 hardware, though we'll be running it in an emulator. And it theoretically supports multi-core, though we won't take advantage of that this semester. There will also be quizzes after each week lecture, starting soon. If you've done quizzes in 3330, it's the same interface. We'll show this starting, I think it's after, right, this is wrong, because I did not think of revising this. Starting this week, which I will talk about on Thursday. Last semester, the first week was half a week, and I didn't think of updating this slide. It will be the same as 3330, there will be no time limit. We'll talk about that more later. Just quick logistics, and their quizzes are open book, open notes, open internet. Just don't IM people saying, hey, what's the answer to this quiz question? Or write Stack Overflow post or whatever. There will be exams. The exam dates are posted. The final date was posted before this class even started. If you can't make those, please let us know. We want to know. And on logistics, there is a recommended textbook, which is this book, Operating Systems Principles in Practice. It's not required, but I think this is a good textbook, particularly for some of the harder parts of this class, like threading. Another option that you consider is this book, Operating Systems 3 Easy Pieces, which is available legally and freely as a PDF online. And I find it a bit more terse than Operating Systems Principles in Practice, but it's free and it's pretty good for the most part. Just maybe not as well written as you might like, or no. And you could also, if you have an old copy of Silver Shirts from someone who took this course several semesters ago, like, you're not going to be at a huge disadvantage. It's like, I'm not using it for a reason, but it covers everything just differently. So, other logistics. So we have homeworks. Homeworks are individual. Please don't use code from prior semesters. Do not share code. Do not share pseudocode. Do not share detailed descriptions of your code. Do not use code from the internet with limited exceptions. This class is not like about string parsing. If you have to split a string into spaces, I don't want you figuring out how to do that in C or C++. Go ahead, look that up, take code from somewhere. Just make sure you cite it and make sure you're not taking code like to do the objective of the assignment. So for example, one of our early assignments is going to be to make a shell. Like, don't take code for, like, starting programs from, you know, starting a pipeline from the internet or other things which are obviously big parts of implementing a shell, but, like, splitting a string by spaces, yeah, this course is not about that. If you have questions, ask. I mentioned for quizzes and for getting help. So we'll have a Piazza set up soon. There will be office hours that will be posted starting next week after I talk to my TAs and figure out what meetings I have to schedule my own office hours around. If you want to meet with me before that, you can email me and I can find a time. That's for getting help. So those are quick logistics and just to let you know. But then I'm going to just go on through just course material, and we're going to start pretty quickly because I mentioned our teaching operating system here. The first assignment for that is listed as released on Friday on the schedule and due the week after Friday. So we're going to try to have you actually set up to do that in a prompt fashion. So we're going to start right away. So questions on logistics before I move on. Yeah?
What should people on the waitlist expect?
Okay, so about the waitlist. So Professor Kwan and I will be sharing homeworks and TAs. So the classes are not going to be that different. And if you are on the waitlist and can register for the other section, I expect you to do so. If you are on the waitlist and have an actual conflict with the other section. A conflict is like, I want to take this course and there's no way I can take this course this semester without registering for the other section. It's not like, I really like to take probability with this math professor and not the other one. Like, if you have a real conflict, email me and I can probably do something about it. But I'm not expecting to increase the capacity of the class as long as we have leftover seats in the other section. If that class fills up somehow, I might do that, but not unless that happens. So other questions? Yeah.
Will you be recording lectures?
Will I be recording lectures? Yes. This is a voice recorder. I should have a screen capture. So I'll be recording lectures, except when I have technical difficulties with my recordings, which will hopefully happen rarely, but who knows. I would note that lecture recordings are not intended to be a substitute for attending lecture. And I think people who try to use them that way generally have bad experiences, but I'm not going to do anything to stop you. Okay, anything else? Okay, so we're talking about operating systems in this course. This is an operating systems course. So what is an operating system? And we have several overlapping definitions. So an operating system, we can think of as an abstraction layer over hardware. That operating system is just a way for our normal programs not to deal with how real hardware works. Instead, we have this other interface. And we can think of it either as sort of abstracting the hardware or just a plain old, the hardware interface is inconvenient. This is a new interface that's hopefully not inconvenient or inconvenient in different ways. Or we can think of an operating system's role as not so much making the hardware interface better or different or abstracting it, but as being about sharing resources. So if we think of a hardware as these roles, so we can think of it as the operating system is what sits between the applications and the hardware. That's one way of viewing what an operating system is. It's everything between your application and the hardware, and it's going to make that hardware, those complexities go away. It's going to provide access to shared resources. So we have multiple applications here. They somehow need to use one piece of hardware. A big part of the operating system's job is letting that happen and choosing an abstraction for the hardware that makes that possible. That we can't just naturally treat our CPU as if everyone can use it at the same time, but that's sort of what our typical desktop operating system does. It looks like everyone's using the same CPU all at once. We have other things that it needs to do. So one thing is communication is sort of a role that doesn't come up in the hardware, that because we have shared resources, these two applications need to talk to each other. And this doesn't have to be fancy, so an example of communicating between two programs is one writes a file, the other reads the same file. That's communication. That's something the operating system is going to be involved in providing security. And sort of a way of looking at it, if we think of the operating system as letting us run multiple applications together, coordinating what they do, is one way you can think about it is that this takes over a job of an operator. So it used to be that computer operator was a real job. Yeah, if you got these very 70s, I think, pictures here, these are computer operators. These machines didn't have that much of an operating system, so humans needed to do things like load programs. And that's things they're doing. And manage, you know, tapes, which are the equivalent of files for the system. And the operating system you can think of as sort of taking over these responsibilities. This is another sort of view of what the operating system is doing, is automating these things that you might have done by hand in a less sophisticated world. And providing you a more convenient interface. So this is sort of the abstraction of the hardware. Another view is that now that the hardware is doing these things, the software is doing these things previously on my hand, the operating system is the piece of software that's taking over that responsibility, because our programs might not be so changed. You know, if we're running an accounting program as App 1 in our modern OS, that's probably the same program they were running in the 70s. So another view is the operating system is just providing a more convenient interface. That maybe we could write all our programs without an operating system, but we just think that real hardware is not designed to write programs. That the real hardware has made all these choices to make it easy for the hardware manufacturer to do things that are inconvenient for our programs. And that the software is going to provide a more convenient interface. And we'll give some examples of that later on. Probably the easiest one to think of is files versus the things you store files on. The file interface, you have a name, like that's something that you can deal with manually. Whereas if you think about a USB stick, the operating system is communicating with the USB stick by saying, I want to get this set of bytes from you. And that's not a convenient interface for, you know, typical programs. The file interface is much better. And we can think of the operating system maybe its primary role is just providing these more convenient interfaces. So it's really all these things together. Our textbook uses this sort of set of ideas, which is that it's a referee, that we're doing resource sharing. This is we need to run multiple things together, and we need to make sure that they don't interfere. So this is referee role our textbook talks about. We have an illusionist idea that we're going to take these complex abstractions, like our USB stick just asks us what bytes do you want by number, and we actually want files, so it's providing these cleaner abstractions, even though the real hardware doesn't provide those cleaner abstractions. And it's providing these common services that lots of programs need, like networking, displaying things on the screen with windows. You know, the screen doesn't know about windows, it just knows about pictures. But you can think of maybe that's an OS component which does that. And whatever definition you use, we have this sort of common goal, which is that the operating system is going to hide complexity. That whatever we're doing, we're taking something which is more complex and doing our standard computer science thing of adding a layer of abstraction, and at least as the designers of the layer of abstraction, we imagine that that makes things less complex. We might not be right, but that's what our guess is. And the big things we're making less complex that in every operating system is that if we have competing applications, previously that would be a complexity, that when you write an application, if we were running on the raw hardware, you need to worry about, is there some other program running alongside me? And if you think about sort of old machines with barely an operating system like DOS, programs really had to worry about this. But on our typical modern OSs, You write a program, you don't worry anywhere when you're writing that program, what if something else is running on the machine? You just write the program, it works no matter what else is happening. We've hidden that from you as part of making an OS. Another thing you don't worry about is varying hardware. So if you're outputting to different types of screens or outputting to an SSH window versus a monitor, the way that works in the hardware is very different. And you just write printf, and it just works. So some layers of abstraction have hid all these differences in hardware interfaces from you, and you have this one common interface which works for everything. You don't worry about exactly what the hardware we're dealing with is. And this means, more importantly perhaps, that when I build my application, I can keep using that for many, many years. You know, that's sort of the operating system provides the stable interface, perhaps more than the hardware does, because it has this single interface that's going to not change even as the underlying hardware moves to new technologies and so on. So from the application program point of view, the reason we love operating systems is you write once, works on lots of hardware, you don't re-implement common functionality like files or displaying windows, and you don't worry about other programs. It just makes your life easier. That's what the operating system is doing. And in this class, we're going to talk about how do we implement various sorts of that functionality. And also, how do we use various sorts of that functionality, like files? How do we run other programs when we actually need to worry about them? What interfaces will we have? And how do we take advantage of things in the hardware that might not be, you know, something where we have a natural interface unless the operating system provides us one? So another way of viewing the operating system is that the operating system is sort of its own machine. That the hardware provides some machine interface, which I'll call a physical machine interface. And the operating system also provides a machine interface. As far as you're concerned, when your program's running, its idea of the hardware is really just the operating system, whatever the operating system has chosen for it to see. And the question is just, what interface do we choose for this red line? Are we going to choose something like the physical interface? And we've seen this. This is what you would usually call a virtual machine is, something like VirtualBox or VMware. They're essentially implementing an operating system, but the interface the operating system provides imitates real hardware. Maybe not the same real hardware it's running on, but it imitates real hardware. But our typical desktop operating system goes to this other end here, where they've said, well, I'm not real hardware. I don't care about running things that think they're on real hardware directly. I'm going to provide an interface that's convenient for application programmers. So they've decided that, you know, I don't care about providing you direct access to a particular part of a disk. I don't care about exposing a fixed number of processors to you. I'm just going to provide a more convenient interface for all this functionality. And that's what we'll be talking about most of the semester. So a lot of what we'll talk about is, what's this more convenient interface? But we can think of it as that this as just choosing a different machine we wish we had for our applications, and we're adding software to implement that different machine. And that our software is going to do the translation to take our chosen for convenience interface and make it work with the real physical interface. So it's just a interface translator. And sometimes that translation is going to be really easy. We'll just, you know, basically be forwarding things without thinking. Sometimes we're going to have to do lots of bookkeeping to make that work. But this is the same sort of thing something like VirtualBox is doing, but in the case of something like VirtualBox, the translation is mostly pretty straightforward. That because we're just taking two similar interfaces and mapping from one to the other. Well, pretty straightforward from a high level. When we talk about virtual machines later, we'll see that maybe things are a little more complicated. So We have our system virtual machines, which you see in VirtualBox VMware, which imitate the hardware interface. And typically, you know, what we like those because they provide portability, because they run operating systems. And we'll also be using something like that for this course. We have a teaching OS. You need to run it in something. You're going to run it in QEMU, which is basically a system virtual machine. It's not VirtualBox because we have something which is easier to configure the way we want it, and also like lets you do things like attach GDB without too much work. We have our process virtual machines, where notably we've made these convenient choices. And these things here are things we'll spend lots of time talking about, each thing on this line. So in our process VM, we're going to have this idea of threads. Threads are our more convenient representation of processors. So rather than have exposed things that look like real processors, we're going to expose this idea of a thread, which is going to be the closest equivalent to a processor for your application program. And because we're doing things in software, we don't need to say, well, you have four threads and that's all you have, and you always have four threads, like we do with processors. If you have four cores, you always have four cores. You're never going to have less or more because that's physically in your machine. With threads, we're just going to say, you can have as many as you want. We'll deal with simulating that for you. Obviously, some numbers will work better than others, and it's not really infinite because we only have so much space, but you can use as many as you want, no matter the real CPUs. This is how we expose the same functionality as multiple processors to application programs. So we're going to have memory allocation functions. So things that look more like malloc and free, you know, are things that the OS might be doing. But in the real hardware, we need to worry about, we have this fixed size memory, we have these page tables, that's the implementation, but we don't expose set your page tables up to the application. We just say allocate memory, we'll figure out where it is. And a big part of what the OS does is deciding, how do I take the application request where I want this much memory, I want to load this file and so on, and turn that into actual page table entries that make efficient use of the memory we have. And we're going to have, in this class, we're going to talk about files. So this open read write close interface. And this is how we're generally going to communicate with I/O devices. This includes things like the disk, the obvious case for files, but also includes things like keyboards, networks. Those are all going to have this file-like interface where we have some open operation, this read operation and this write operation, which take a bunch of bytes, and the operating system is going to deal with what the actual device interface is, and we'll talk about what that is later in the semester. Like, what does the device actually expect? But the abstraction to an application is this file interface where you open something and read or write to it. So questions on any of these abstractions here? Yeah?
Is thread a purely software concept, or is it something that's also present in CPUs, like the actual hardware CPUs?
So the question is, thread a purely a software concept, or is there a CPU concept of threads? So there is something in processors that's sometimes called symmetric multi-threading, which you can think of as thread, a concept in processors. For this class, when we talk about threads, we always mean the software concept. And we will refer to the hardware concept as processors. In the case where hardware does the equivalent of multi-threading, we'll probably call those logical processors. But we probably won't talk about that much. But there is something similar that's done in hardware where the implementation looks approximately like what threads look like if you from a high level, but it's exposed to the operating system as multiple processors. But what we'll talk about in this class, we're just talking about implementing software, so we're gonna talk about the software concept. So other questions? Okay, so that's our, okay. So we can think of this translation view, as I said, is what we'll call the abstract virtual machine. So when the OS is providing all these abstractions, you may call it the application's running in this abstract virtual machine. And the OS's choice of machine, machine is what application C is their machine. So there's no hardware details visible, so this is future-proof and has the more featureful interfaces than the real hardware. And as I said, the operating system's goal is just to translate one interface into another. So for example, if we're running an application, we have an abstraction to represent a running program, and we're going to call that abstraction a process. You probably vaguely remember seeing that before in some prior course, I hope. But a process represents an application, notably including its registers, including its program counter, and its memory. So we have this process thing which you can manipulate in the OS's interface, and that turns into registers and actual memory allocation that are mapped to the real hardware. So that's the translation the operating system is doing. And when the application is running, those registers might be on the CPU. The processor might actually have the same register values that are part of the process. And if we have some other application which is not running, those registers might be in the memory along with the application's memory. And the operating system is taking care of making this happen. So even though we can't be on the processor the whole time, from our point of view, we just have a process. It always has registers, no matter where those registers are stored, whether they're actually on the processor because we're running right now, or they're being stored somewhere else because we can't be on the processor and the processor only has one set of registers, even though we have many processes running at once. And the operating system is going to take care of deciding, well, application 2 needs to run now, therefore I need its registers to be the actual CPU registers. I need the CPU to load its instructions, so it needs to have its program counter and its RAX value and so on. So it's going to take care of switching to the program and moving, saving the registers of the non-running process somewhere. So this is part of how the OS is implementing this process abstraction. We also have files. So files, as I said, are how we're going to access all sorts of I/O devices. So the application has this single interface of files, and the operating system is going to have all sorts of cases for turning that into how all of these I/O devices work. And this is notably, even though these I/O devices clearly work differently, like a keyboard or mouse, clearly we're going to have a different way of talking to it than something like disks or a monitor. But the operating system is going to provide this single interface that encapsulates all of them, and it's going to figure out how to turn that into what the device actually expects when we communicate with it. So another thing the OS provides is the exceptional cases for machines. So for example, let's say an application tries to access memory it's not supposed to. The OS is going to make it so accessing that memory triggers some event that's predictable, like a segmentation fault, rather than what would happen on real hardware, which is, who knows, there's probably something at that memory location if we were running on the raw hardware without. The OS is going to provide this protection both from mistakes and to prevent application one from, say, trying to, let's say we had app two's data here, it can't access it. It's going to get a seg fault instead, even if it knows where it is. Okay. So questions about these abstractions? So we saw the process there. So I talked about this process. To be more precise, we're going to say a process is our thread plus an address space. So the address space is the memory you can access. And the thread is your notion that you have your own CPU. This is means that you have your own program counter plus registers and so on. And that's basically what the thread is. The address space is the memory you can access. And each process is going to have its own one of these. And that's the big abstraction the OS provides to represent a running application. That each application is a process, and the process seems to get its own machine with this nice hardware interface that kind of looks like real hardware but has these more convenient abstractions. And a big thing the OS needs to do is when we're running multiple applications, I showed you this segmentation fault idea, and we want to keep applications from interfering with each other. We want to keep them from crashing each other, you know, either on purpose or by accident. And we have some hardware support to help us do this. And you've seen a bunch of this before. Hopefully this is kind of review. And the big piece of hardware support we have to implement this idea of keeping these multiple processes, which each seem to have their own dedicated machine, from stamping on each other while letting the OS do whatever it wants to all the processes. You know, the OS needs to be able to manage all the programs, but the program shouldn't be able to manage any other program. So the processor has some special support for this, which is known as dual mode operation. So our processor is going to have some privilege mode called kernel mode and a user mode. And the way we're going to keep any program from doing anything is that in the hardware, as a way to help operating systems work, we're going to have some operations require kernel mode, and we're going to construct our hardware so the OS can make sure we never ever run the user program in kernel mode. So only OS code runs in kernel mode, and in this way, only the OS can do these special operations. The other thing we need is we need address translation, which I think who hasn't seen virtual memory, which I think is everyone's seen virtual memory in some prior class. Good. So that's address translation, and that's the idea that, well, having some operations require kernel mode wouldn't be enough if we can't keep you from writing the code that runs in kernel mode. We don't need to overwrite the OS's code or overwrite the OS's copy of another program's registers, but we want you to still be able to write to memory. So our mechanism for that is address translation, that the OS decides what memory you can access. And this is how we implement the address space part of the process abstraction, that the OS gets to choose this mapping that your program can use. And the idea is that, you know, those are the addresses you can access. Anything else the OS sets to trigger an error. So program A literally has no way to get to program it. Program B has no way to get the program A's code, for example. It can't read it, it can't write it, it just can't get to it. And that's how we're going to keep the programs separate from each other. And program B, it can get to the OS's data, but that's marked as kernel mode only in this mapping. So what the processor is going to do is that if we're not running in kernel mode, it's going to say, nope, can't do that, sorry. And that's how we're going to keep program B from, for example, if this OS's data contains program A's saved registers. Program B can't write those because it's kernel mode only. It would need to run in kernel mode, and only code chosen by the OS is going to be able to do that. So these are our two most important pieces of hardware support, and we're going to talk about, especially near the beginning of the semester, a bunch of things related to this. So this idea of having this kernel mode, and how do we switch to the kernel mode? How do we decide what runs in this kernel mode where the OS can do these important operations? And address translation, which we'll talk more about later, of how do we set up a program's memory? How do we manage the memory? But these are important mostly because they provide the functionality of allowing us to have two programs run alongside each other and look like they have their own processor, that thread abstraction, and look like they have their own copy of the memory, that address space abstraction. That's how we implement the process. So we're going to talk about these a lot, as I said. These are not the only ways to implement processes. So there are other ways you can implement processes. We're just not going to do it because they're not common today, but these aren't the only options. Okay. So I talked about our way of protecting applications. So that keeps applications from overwriting the data of other applications and so on. But there's some other things we need to happen. That I don't want it to be the case that if I'm running a program and I click the mouse for another program, that if the program I'm running right now is buggy, that mouse click never does anything. And to make this happen, the OS is going to need a mechanism to respond to events. Like if I press a key, the OS needs to be able to act on that, even if the program which wants the key press, the program which should read the key press, is not the one that's currently on the CPU. And another example is if I write an infinite loop, it sure would not be very nice if starting that infinite loop program means now I need to reboot my machine. And we know that's not what operating systems do. So we need some way for the operating system to respond to these events, even though they're not part of the program they're running. And because we're using dual mode operation to implement this protection, we're going to have the program running just on the real processor, just not in kernel mode. So it's going to be on the processor, and the processor is going to be running this code that's in the application, and we need that to stop happening so the OS can run. Because in the simplest case, we have a single processor machine. Where else can the OS run? Nowhere. So somehow it needs to get running on that single processor. So there's a mechanism to do this, and we're going to have hardware help to make this happen. And that's going to be the exception. So an exception is where the hardware is going to help us out and let the OS respond to some sort of event and start running, even though it was running some user code that was completely unrelated, that didn't specify the OS at all, that might have been buggy, might have been running an infinite loop that had no way to stop it. We're going to still have a way of running the OS to respond to things like pressing a key or the program running for longer than the OS wanted it to. And exceptions are tightly tied to this dual mode operation idea. This idea that sometimes we're going to be in kernel mode and be able to access more memory, do more hardware operations. Exceptions are the way we switch to and from kernel mode, basically. And the rule we're going to have in operating systems we'll talk about in this class is user code always runs in user mode. There are no exceptions. We'll always run it in user mode, and only the OS code will run in kernel mode. So, and when this exception event happens, when the hardware decides that some special event happened that needs the operating system to run, like a key press, the hardware will change from user to kernel mode. That's how the OS code will end up running in kernel mode, is that an exception will happen and the OS is running and now it's kernel mode. And this is the only mechanism we'll have for doing so. There's not going to be like a switch to kernel mode instruction that you can put in your user program. If you want to switch to kernel mode, you need to trigger one of these events the OS is waiting for. So exceptions have a bunch of terminology. So you might remember from CS3330, we used these terms. So we called exceptions triggered by an external event interrupts. we called exceptions triggered by the program doing something bad, false. So far, I've only sort of talked about interrupts because these are the most important for isolating programs. This is like our key press, our timer. We have some other types of exceptions that come up. So one are faults, where the program does something bad. So if the program tries to access memory that isn't valid, I had trigger an error because it wasn't in the map, the hardware needs to know, what do I do? You know, we don't want the hardware to just say, return a random value for the program's memory access. Instead, what we're gonna do is we're gonna run the OS, ask the OS what to do. The exception is the mechanism for doing that. And this is gonna happen to switch to kernel mode, which is helpful so the OS can do things like run a different program, change the app mapping for another program because this program's crashed, for example. We also have this category of traps. And we need traps for, most notably, system calls. So this is how we request an OS service. So if we want to start a new thread, if we want to open a file, we can't do that ourselves. We need to ask the OS to do that. And the interface for doing that is going to be by deliberately triggering an exception so the OS can run, and so it can run in kernel mode in order to actually trigger the relevant event. So we're going to deal with all of these in this class. The most obvious kind is interrupts, because that's what we need to keep, you know, to do something even though the program is monopolizing the CPU. The other ones on this list are somehow triggered by what the program is doing, either unintentionally or intentionally. But we also have those, so the OS can respond to those events in the programs, either the program making a mistake or the program deliberately trying to ask the OS to do something for it that doesn't really have its own instruction otherwise. So these are CS3330 terms. Unfortunately, no one is consistent about what they call exceptions. And we're gonna be using XP6, as I mentioned. And XP6 uses different terms. They call everything a trap or an interrupt, and they don't really carefully distinguish the names for the kinds, except that faults are pretty consistent. I'm sorry about that. In the real world, look for context clues. You're not gonna guess. And I'm mentioning this because we're gonna have an assignment which involves adding a system call to XP6 as the first assignment, so this will be relevant. So I mentioned that trap is where we want to do services, and these are all sorts of things where, well, we need some way of writing the OS, and it happens that exceptions do that, but we also need the OS to do something that needs kernel mode anyways, like allocating memory. We need to change that address space mapping. That's going to be a privileged operation because we don't want any program to just access any memory. That would violate the rule that programs can't change other programs' memory or change the OS's memory. Accessing I/O devices, that's generally going to require kernel mode, so anything which does that is going to need one of these deliberate exceptions to run the OS, because we need to switch to kernel mode, and remember, this is the only way we can do it. So to make this work, pretty much every architecture you can think of has an instruction to deliberately trigger an exception. This instruction still works basically like a normal exception. It runs some OS chosen code, which is going to respond to the event just like you respond to a key press, except presumably that code is not going to do the same thing it would do for a key press. Like, it's going to pay more attention to what program was running rather than what program was waiting for a key press. And this is how the program requests privileged instructions. So we think about, here's some x86-64 Linux assembly. The way a system call typically works is that the program, before the exception happens, sets some registers. It sets some registers because these are an easy place to put data where the OS can read it. And Linux made this arbitrary choice that they're going to use RAX, RSI, RDI, R8, R9, and a few other registers to put information about system call services. This is just a convention, like a calling convention that Linux made. So you set those registers, then you run this special instruction. And when Linux booted up the machine, it set up so that special instruction moves control. The hardware will start running code in kernel mode. That's a system call handler specified by Linux. The name isn't actually syscall handler, but simple. And this is where we'll look at the values of these registers and figure out what do we actually want to do based on that. So this code here is going to say, this is a write to standard out, and this is the address of the data you want to write, and it's going to do the operation based on that. And when it's done, it's going to run another special instruction to return from that exception and move back to user mode. We need a special instruction because we don't want to ever run user code in kernel mode. So we need an instruction which will switch back to user mode. And on x86, the iwrite instruction is one way of doing that. iwrite for return from interrupt. So the hardware, we have this pointer we set during boot. That's how the hardware knows where to go. And when we're running in user mode, all the privileged operations won't work. When we're running in kernel mode, that's when we can do our special things like changing I/O layout, or in this case, I/O operations are allowed in that mode. So questions about sort of this layout? Okay, so you might say, well, if this is how I/O works, then, so we're just writing these system calls all the time. Is that what we're doing? And the answer is actually no. So this is what the classic sort of Unix operating system looks like, and this is what we'll be talking about most of this semester. There are other ways of designing an OS, but we'll talk about the Unix design. And the Unix design, we have this system call interface. So these are all the things you use system calls to make happen. And this is how you access what's called the kernel. The kernel is the name I'm going to use for all the code that we run in kernel mode in this case. And there's some code on top of that, which is some standard libraries and utility functions. So for example, printf on Linux is not a system call. It's a library function that makes system calls. So that's part of the C library, and that library is not running kernel mode. It just makes system calls that actually do the writing in kernel mode, but most of it runs in user mode, so that's the C standard library. We have a whole bunch of other things that run that are standard with the system, like the login program, the program where you type your password into, that runs in user mode. Yes, it needs to ask the OS to actually read from the keyboard, but that's a program that is written in user mode and does all the looking at your username and so on, and showing, deciding what prompt to display. That's all user mode code. The shell where you type ls minus l, that has to ask the OS to like start a new process and so on, but all that code runs in user mode. And there's a philosophical question of whether we should consider the operating system to be decided based on the boundary we provide from this library, or whether we really think the operating system is the boundary provided by the system call interface. And you'll find different people will say different things about it. And so we're not going to make a decision, but I'm just pointing out that when you see people talk about what's an operating system, you'll get both answers. You'll have some people who say, yeah, the operating system's all this stuff. It's everything, including the libraries you use, and which hide the system calls. Or they'll say, the operating system's just this core stuff, which actually deals with what runs in kernel mode. Or is that core interface to actually talk to the devices and not the abstractions you've chosen to use on top of that. So there's no consensus on this, on where the line is. But this is sort of what our notion of an OS is, one of these two. And we're mostly going to talk in this semester about things down here. We'll talk a little about shells. And we'll talk certainly about what the interface looks like. We generally won't be writing raw system calls, but we'll be using functions which wrap system calls on Linux pretty much like directly. Like there's a library function, but all it does is make a system call with the same arguments. Like, so pretty close to that. So we'll mostly talk about that, but people, when they talk about what an OS is, they often mean a lot of code that isn't part of this kernel. They often consider part of the OS, and we're not going to settle the question of whether that counts or not. Whether it's just the stuff that runs in kernel mode, the stuff that actually needs to balance between what programs get run, if it's the libraries you need to access that, even though you could replace those with a different set of libraries, you could write your own, or not use them. If it includes all the utility programs, like do we think the shell is part of the OS, you could replace it with a different one, but it's kind of a core part of the machine. Do we include like the notepad, is that part of the OS? You know, this is a fuzzy line depending on what you do, and we're not gonna settle that issue, but in this class, we're mostly talking about how we implement things which in the Unix design are in the kernel. That are done, these services that we're providing to abstract the hardware that in Unix would be implemented in kernel mode. Okay. And I said we're mostly talking about Unix, and this is partly because of our teaching OS. We're using a teaching OS called XV6. The name is because it's based on 6th edition Unix. So the backstory is that apparently MIT was previously using the actual 6th edition Unix source code, and they decided sometime in like the 90s that this was a little inconvenient because we have to like teach PDP 11 assembly, which wasn't very relevant even in the 90s. So they decided to write a new OS that used 32-bit x86. So that's a little more relevant, so you can at least have an assembly language that you might actually use. And it implements multi-core instead of that. But it's a design heavily inspired by what 6th edition Unix did. And you might think that OSs have fundamentally changed in their design over the past 40 years, but as far as commercially released OSs, this mostly isn't true. So from a high level, most commercial OSs look like this, even though there are some different popular OS designs out there. Okay, so for XV6, the first assignment in XV6 is we have system calls, and your assignment is to add a new system call. And the assignment includes download instructions for XV6. XV6, because it's a teaching OS, and one of the reasons I'm using it is it comes with a book, a PDF, that is pretty thorough. Documenting what it does. It might not be like the most readable thing because it assumes some background and it varies whether it's the same stuff you know versus what they assume MIT students know, but it's much more than say if we were using actual Linux where that's kind of scattered around. To run this, you will need a Linux VM. We will supply one. It should be up now. Linked off there, or you can get your own. We'll also have department lab accounts, but I should cross this out, but not for QMU. Sorry. The department would not like you running an emulator, a virtual machine, on the massively shared login clusters. So please don't do that. So you need QMU installed, which is the emulator we'll be using it. If you're on Ubuntu or Debian, it's this package. If you download our VM image, it's pre-installed, so you don't have any work to do. It should just work. Right. And yeah, the department login server is just not gonna be an alternative for the XV6 assignments, just because they don't want us running things which use a lot of CPU. doesn't use much memory, but uses a lot of CPU. Okay, so that. So first assignment, let's get it working. So let's talk about what's included. So XV6 has a Unix-like kernel. So it has this single system call interface. And it's similar to the system calls you'll actually see on Linux if you're familiar with them. A lot of them are less featureful. For example, there's an exit system call, which doesn't take an exit status. That sure makes it simpler, but that's not what you would see from a real Unix system. It has a user space C library. The C library is very limited, but it does have a printf, at least, and it has some command line programs. So right, because we have a more limited interface, the way you write XV6 programs looks a little different than what you might be used to. So notably, this is echo.c. So echo.c, if you type in your terminal in XV6, and I'll demonstrate this in a second, if you type echo foo, it prints foo, and then you get another prompt. So this is the source code for that program. We have some include files. Note that these are not standard I/O. It's not the same functions. Do not try to include standard library files. It either won't work or will do something really confusing. So we have a main function, and I have argv and argc, like you might remember from 2150 when you last wrote code dealing with arguments. And here we have printf, and you might say, wait, printf1? What's the 1 for? So the XV6 printf takes a file descriptor, and we'll talk about this later. So 0 equals in standard in, 1 equals standard out, 2 equals standard error. So usually with printf you want 1, but it takes that, even though it's called printf. That's just what they have chosen to do. Otherwise it works like printf does. Note that unlike printf, because they have their own implementation, it doesn't implement all the things you might be used to with printf. Like you're not going to use all the field widths if you are used to that. They just aren't supported. Another thing you might notice is rather than this main returning 0, it exits. The way XV6 starts executables is that the main is literally the first instruction which runs, so there's nothing set up for it to return to. So if you return from main, your program will do the equivalent of segfaulting. So if you want to exit normally, you have to actually call exit. On real Linux, there's some code that the compiler provides which runs main, and that main returns to does the same thing, but you have to do it manually here. The main function is actually the first code which runs. There's no compiler provided code that's also running before main. So questions? This? Okay, so. So here I have an unpacked copy of XV6. So in the assignment, we have instructions for cloning a Git repository. And after you do that, you can run make, and it will build everything, assuming you have an appropriate compiler. And if we look in here, so if we look at the C and H files, we have some files which are commands, so like we have our echo.c, that's a command, and we have some files which are implementations of the operating system, like this syscall.c, for example, which we'll talk more about probably next time. Now, once you've built this, you need some way of actually running it, and we have two targets in the make file for that. So one is make qmu no x, and if I run that, because I have qmu installed, it starts the OS. So this is an actual terminal prompt, I'm sorry, it's at the bottom of the screen. Inside my OS, there's an ls command. Well, let's start with echo. I mentioned we saw that echo before. So I type echo foo, I get foo. If I type ls, I see the files we have. There's a readme, there's a cat, there's echo, the executable I just ran. And a few other utilities in here. There's a shutdown utility, which executes a shutdown system call, which we can use. And there's also sh is our shell. Note that there's no subdirectories in here. It's a very minimal OS. This is like all the files we have. And part of make builds this file system for us. So if you want to add an executable, we have instructions for doing that. You add it to the make file and it will appear in this file system. And that's how you add something to here. You are not going to compile something inside XV6. We don't have a compiler for it, that, except for one that you run on your host operating system, the one that runs QEMU. And run shutdown. Yes, it gives an error because the exit status, but that's normal. So on. Yes?
What do the numbers mean?
I don't remember offhand. One of them, the last one's the size. The other two are other things that would appear in ls-l or some version of ls, like link count or something. I don't actually know offhand. You can read the ls source code. It's probably very simple. There's also, in addition to make QEMU nox, there's a make QEMU target, which runs in a separate window, which might look more like a genuine machine, but it's not running the same thing. You can do whatever is more convenient for how you're set up. Okay, so any questions? Yes?
Does the second just use like the X display or whatever?
So the second uses the local display. Yeah, so the NOX stands for no X11. X11 is the window system for Linux. I have instructions for this somewhere. You can run this with a you can run this in a way where you can attach GDB to it with a QEMU nox GDB or QEMU GDB. I won't demo that today, but that's a thing which exists. Should you want that, it lets you run GDB on the operating system itself, which could be handy or might not be. Okay. So any other XV6 questions? Yes.
Does that stay kind of contained? Can we actually like mess up our actual OS?
The question is that contained? Yes. So it has its own memory and own disk. And in fact, by default, the disk, unless you run a special mode, the disk is reset every time you boot it. So you can't even mess up its own disk. So you can just run. And as I said, our recommendation is to use a VM for that. The Department for Shared Machines, the issue is it uses like several hundred megs of RAM and pins the CPU. So that's not bad for your laptop, but probably not something we want running on a machine with 300 users. Okay, so that was XV6. And I just talked about system calls. And we saw in this echo code that we were making this, I mentioned that this xset is a system call. This is a system call wrapper. So this calls some function which looks something like this code here. That's all the function has. That's one of the services XV6 provides. XV6 has a pretty small set of system calls, so this is most of them. So you have system calls for the service of, I want to run programs. So you saw I booted up XV6, I ran echo. I need to ask the operating system to do that for me. I can't just load a file and start running it. So there's some system calls for doing that, for waiting for it to finish, So we have fork, exec, wait, kill. We'll talk more about what those look like later on. I have to be able to read and write files. I didn't exactly show that, but we have system calls for that. Open and close, opening files, closing files. And when you have a file opened, reading and writing them. And note that this includes sort of files, includes on disk, or the screen, or the keyboard, or the monitor. All these work the same way. You just have it's the same functions. You're just accessing not the disk, but showing something on the screen, but you're gonna use the write system call to do that. And it depends on what arguments supply, where it goes. We also have directory operations, so creating things in directories, changing directories, and so on. And there's a few others that probably mostly won't come up, like shutdown, for example. That's a useful system call. Okay. So let's talk about what an XV6 system call really looks like. And we'll finish this up next time, since we're almost out of time. By just sort of stepping through, starting from what happens when we make a system call. So for example, XV6 has a write system call, and this is how that printf function I showed you earlier will actually send something to the screen. So here is an example of a call to write. So we're specifying a file descriptor, a file descriptor number, which identifies where do I want to send the output. One usually means the screen, not always. And specify what I want to output, in this case, hello world new line, and how many bytes that is. So those are the arguments. And this is what I write in my C code. And this somehow gets turned into an actual system call. So I'm calling this write function. But the write function is not an exception. Remember, we need an exception to go to kernel mode to do the privileged operation of talking to the screen. We can't just talk to the screen directly from any program. So we need some way of entering kernel mode. And what we have in XV6, there's a bunch of little assembly functions in this file usys.s, which are called system call wrappers. So these functions are just little C functions you can call from C, and their entire job is just to run the exception that will do the equivalent system call. So most importantly, this contains an instruction that will trigger an exception. And in the case of XV6, the instruction they use is the int or interrupt instruction, which takes a parameter saying which type of interrupt to trigger. In this case, it's the one numbered hex 40. We'll see where that comes up later when the kernel is setting up the information for the processor to use to know what code to execute. And before we actually trigger the exception and start the kernel code running, we set this value 16 in EAX. And XV6 has made this decision that all of our system calls are going to use the same interrupt instruction. You might say, why do we do that? There's a number there. Why aren't we using that? We just aren't. And the way we tell whether it's a read or a write or a shutdown is based on the value of EAX when that exception happens. So you've made this choice that 16 in EAX means it's a write. If it was something else, it might be a read or a shutdown. And as far as the arguments, we're going to have the kernel look for them in the same way as the normal Linux calling convention, so we don't have to do any work. So those arguments are there. In the case of 32-bit x86, they're on the stack. The kernel is going to look for them on the stack in this exception handler. So we don't do any work to fix those, move those anywhere. So any questions so far? Yeah?
So if we define a new system call, we need to go in syscall.h and add
So the question is, for defining a new system call, we're going to need to add something to syscall at h? Yes, you're going to need to add something to syscall at h. And you're probably going to want a wrapper function, so you could use it from C code without writing assembly. So you're going to add something to usys.s. And there's a few other places where you're going to need to specify it.
And also, what does that 14 stand for?
The 14, this is string len of hello world. It's how many bytes to write. This write system call you can use with non-strings. Like you can write 30 bytes to a file if it's a binary file, so it needs to specify a length in bytes. We can't rely on null termination. Okay, other questions? Okay, so this is the user mode side. And we need to somehow have XV6, when it boots up, it needs to make sure that this interrupt instruction here ends up running code that will actually do the write. So how do we do that? So the code for that in XV6 is in the file track.c, and I've only shown some relevant parts. And XV6 has some code to wrap assembly instructions. So this function LIDT here wraps the LIDT for load interrupt descriptor table function. So this is a privileged instruction, something only the OS can do, which says, hey processor, this is where I want exceptions to go. So that points to a table with this instruction, which says, this is the location to go, this is where you look up the locations to go to on exceptions. And this table contains an entry for every number of exception. In this case, we need an entry for the number 0x40, which we just saw back here, this number here. So we set up that entry of the table. There's this macro they use. You would think it's just an address. Sorry, it's more complicated than that. But the important part is that we run this macro and we say, I want to set up this entry of the table to be something for something that points to a particular piece of code to run. And that vector's tsyscall is the piece of code we want to run. I'll show you where that code comes from in a bit. So I'll just go quickly over have here. So we need to specify, this is the entry of the table I want to fill in. So it's the one for hex 40. And one thing I need to specify is, should I allow this to be deliberately triggered in user mode? So that's what DPL user means here. If we didn't do that, if XV6 didn't do that, instead of triggering this exception, it would trigger a fault for you did something you weren't supposed to do. So we need to tell the processor, yes, this interrupt instruction should actually run this handler, not the one for the process messed up, like the seg fault type handler. We need to specify this argument here, which says, yes, I want it to run in kernel mode. You would think we wouldn't specify that. X86 had some extra functionality in mind that we don't care about. But that's why that's here. This is telling the processor, yes, run in kernel mode when you have this exception. X86 supports not doing that should you want to do it. In XV6, we have absolutely no reason to ever do anything but run in kernel mode on an exception. There's an option whether we disable interrupts or not. And in this case, we've said not to. So this means that when I make a system call, if there's a key press in the middle of that, we handle the key press immediately rather than waiting for us to finish, say, writing something to the screen before we handle the key press. And this is a choice XV6 has made, is that they're going to allow things like key presses to interrupt the system call that's running. And the important part is we need to specify, well, what function should I actually run? And that's going to be this vector's tsys call, and this is a pointer to a piece of an assembly function called vector64, which I will show you later, probably next time. So that's what I have for today. So I'll see you on Thursday.